the J Talk Podcast.
Your ham is oishi.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, right off the top this week, I should thank you for your kind words in Paul Williams's hatchet job on me on the Optus Sport Australia website that went live on Wednesday morning.
Oh, no problem at all. And thanks to Paul for the article. And it was great to see you get some recognition after almost a decade covering Japanese football on this podcast and nearly 400 episodes. Yeah, it was all the praise is richly deserved.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, that is quite a milestone coming up on the horizon, isn't it, Sam, for us? Yeah, no, for episode number 400 on the way soon. I'd like to thank Paul very much for the opportunity to have a chat with him and for thinking of the idea to do the article in the first place. And yes, once again, thanks to you, Sam, also to Scott McIntyre and to Kei Koyama for their kind words in the piece as well. And you might have noticed in the intro music, listeners, we've made it big. We've even managed to score a cameo from Sylvester Stallone in the theme music there. That's a clip taken from an Ito Ham commercial from, it's got to be the mid to late 80s. Fantastic to have Sly along with us this week. And I should give a shout out to the YouTube channel 83 Chris Aaron, who has a wide range of Ito Ham commercials featuring Sylvester Stallone on them. So, I managed to pick out a little soundbite today to commemorate Junya Ito's two goals for Japan in this international break, Sam. I don't know. We wondered how much longer Hajime Moriyasu would be in charge of the Japan national team. They've managed to scrape 2-1-0 away victories in this international break. But I don't know about you. They just they always leave me wanting more, or actually the complete opposite. I don't want to watch them anymore. They're not really that fun to watch these days, are they?
No, not at all. That's exactly what I was feeling at half time in the Oman game. Goodness me, that was one of the worst first halves I've ever witnessed. And thankfully, the rare sight of Kara Mitoma coming on made me actually want to watch the second half. But yeah, there were two really poor games again. Japan, Moriyasu is clinging on to his job, getting through the thanks to Australia as well for drawing with Saudi Arabia and China. And somehow this Japan team are second and have a qualification in their own hands. But yeah, two very lifeless performances, especially the game against Vietnam and the first half against Oman. There were slight positives in the second half. They at least attacked a little bit, but still really disjointed and not great viewing once again from Japan.
No, definitely not. So, last Thursday night, Japan travelled over to Vietnam and Ito scored the only goal of the game, at least the only goal that counted in the 17th minute, arriving just in the nick of time in the centre to convert a Takumi Minamino cross in from the left. But Sam, I mean, that was a fairly scrappy effort from Ito. He then went on to score an absolute screamer. What was it? In the last 10 minutes of the first half, might have been about 5 minutes to go before the break, before the officiating crew basically made the J-League VARs look like Usain Bolt. The amount of time they spent looking at whether Al Tanaka was a fraction offside and then whether he was impeding the view of the Vietnamese goalkeeper. To me, it seemed really shambolic and ultimately just in no way were they correcting a clear and obvious error. So I couldn't believe the goal didn't stand, but it ultimately didn't. And that meant that, yes, the second half especially was, you were watching between your fingers, weren't you? Because all it would take would be one slip from a Japanese defender, one loose pass here or there, and a Vietnamese a player might be able to take advantage. So it should have been much more comfortable, but ultimately, I guess they've just about scraped it.
Just about. They were helped really by Vietnam going forward, because they've got some very good technical players, especially in midfield. But I felt as soon as they got past the Japanese midfield and they were faced with the goal, they just kind of panicked and thought, oh my word, we're here. And they just shot from anywhere and just have no real conviction going forward. I think a better team would have exploited Japan on that night. Ito's goal was clear and obvious. It absolutely wasn't. The goal was first given. It's not quite clear if Tanaka was offside in the first place. Then if he was he really blocking the sight of the ball? For the goalkeeper, I don't think he really was. And it's certainly, if it's going to take 5 minutes or whatever it took here, it can't be a clear and obvious decision. So yeah, pretty shambolic. And I've seen a clip from, I think it was a Saudi Arabia-China game, where I think it was even clearer offside, if it was offside at all, and they actually awarded the goal in similar circumstances. So no sort of consistency from the AFC there. But yeah, it was just that second half, without getting the second goal, it was fairly nervy. Japan, in both of these games, Japan should be the superior side. They should be the team that is taking it to the opposition. And they just kind of looked panicked, and they didn't look brave enough on the ball. And it allowed these Vietnam and Oman to have a little bit of confidence, Oman a bit more so. And yeah, you just really want Japan to put them to the sword, and the teams like this are to the sword, and they just really didn't. And I think it's got to come down from the manager, because all the players on the pitch for their clubs will go forward. They will look to play risky passes. They will look to be expressive. And for whatever reason, they get the Japan shirt on and they kind of have frozen over the last couple of games.
Yeah, it's really puzzling, isn't it? Obviously, we did wonder what Moriyasu might do in terms of a selection ahead of the Vietnam game. I mean, you could argue that his hand was somewhat forced in the lead-up when a number of players who were travelling over from Europe were forced to skip a day of training, I believe, when their charter plane had to refuel in Russia or some such malarkey like that. So the likes of Kyogo Furuhashi, who a lot of us would have expected to start up front, or hoped to see rather up front, knowing Moriyasu's love affair with Yuya Osako, probably weren't expecting it, but it would have liked to have seen it. But ultimately, against Vietnam, Moriyasu went with his tried and trusted. And I don't know, we obviously don't think we saw enough in that game for him to leave it as it was. But basically, that's what he did for the Oman game on Tuesday, their time, Wednesday morning Japan time, that marked the beginning of the second half of this qualification period. Japan obviously looking to get revenge, Sam, for that defeat to Oman back in September in the first qualifier. And yeah, they just about done it. But again, aside from Gaku Shibasaki replacing the suspended Hidemasa Morita, it was the same, exactly the same team. And to no one's surprise, they produced another very ordinary performance.
No, it wasn't a surprise. I mean, he changed the formation for the Australia game. It was like, you can't lose this one. They had to get something from it. And he played against an Australia team that are good in midfield, so it makes sense to have three solid midfielders in there. But these two games, you're playing against the weakest teams in the group, Vietnam and Oman. It doesn't need that many more defensive-minded players. And it just left a massive gap between midfield and striker. And Osako, if you're going to play Osako there, he needs players to link off with. So to have that cavernous gap there, there was nothing being built up. And it had the wingers wide, and Minamino's not really a left winger, especially not one that hugs the touchline. And it just was so disjointed. And it was just like, he got this system that quotes worked against Australia, which I thought Australia played quite poorly in that game, and Japan, yeah, they sneaked the victory. But he's just kind of like, doesn't want to get out of his comfort zone at all. He's found this thing that he thinks works, and he's not going to move away from it unless he's absolutely forced into it, which he was by that first half performance against Oman, because he actually brought players on there, but I don't think it could have got any worse. And even Moriyasu could have seen that from that performance. But yeah, his just main focus is to go to what's safe. And yeah, this team and these players need a lot more of an expressive manager. They need one that is going to let them off the leash a little bit, because they've got to be playing a lot better against Oman and Vietnam.
Yes, most definitely. And so, yeah, you mentioned it earlier, Sam. We had a sighting of the lesser spotted Kaoru Mitoma, who actually came on at halftime to make his full national team debut. And, well, Sam, you tweeted it yourself. To nobody's surprise, yeah, he came on and he was quite good at football. And if only Hajime Moriyasu had have known that. When the Olympics were going on, he hardly played him there, did he either? So, yes, it was a process for Moriyasu, but he finally managed to, as you say, I guess he was just shaken into action by the dour first half, where Japan's best chance, I guess, was midway through the first 45 when Yuto Nagatomo crossed from the left and Junya Ito made a mess of his volley and, bounced the ball onto the roof of the net. But yes, for the second straight game, Ito went ham, and Ito was Japan's hero, converting an assist in from the left again, arriving in the center to not quite bundle in, but yes, volley in Kaoru Mitoma's assist with 9 minutes to go, Sam. And I did want to talk about a number of players over the course of these two games, but as we work our way through, I guess, Moriyasu's team, and eventually get onto a question from one of our patrons, Nick Walker. I did want to talk about the defense right off the top, because we had, I don't know the best way to describe it. Shuichi Gonda hadn't been in great form, had he, for Shimizu in the last month or so, perhaps in between the two international breaks. And we wondered whether Moriyasu should be putting his trust in Gonda ahead of these couple of games. But I don't know, has he done enough here to win you around again? Two clean sheets. It obviously has a lot to do with the defense in front of him. But as we work our way from back to front, how did you feel Gonda performed over the course of the two games?
I think it's hard to really judge him on these two games. Vietnam very rarely got close to the area, and Oman had a couple of moments where they got a few crosses in, but again, rarely tested him. And what he had to do, he did quite well and quite competently. But yeah, I wouldn't say this has necessarily boosted him at all. I'm still worried about the goalkeeper situation for Japan. The only saving grace for Gonda is there's not necessarily an outstanding candidate to take over from him. They're all kind of much of a muchness, and neither of them are up to much, to be honest. I mean, there are calls for Kosei Tani to take over, but I mean, he's only 20. I still thought he looked quite shaky at times in the Olympics. And do you want to go into a World Cup if Japan get there with a 20-year-old goalkeeper? So I think Gonda's probably going to be settled in for the duration, at least while Moriyasu is there. But, I mean, there were competent performances. But, again, there'll be bigger tests for him. And maybe January will be the one where we'll look to see if Shuichi Gonda has improved at all.
All right. Well, at least it's not Eiji Kawashima, Sam. So we can...
He's still making squads. I'm worried that he's going to make...
Yes, for now we can count our blessings, but certainly not counting any chickens, as we could reappear at any time, no question at all. Now, at right back, we saw Miki Yamane from Kawasaki start both games. Obviously, Hiroki Sakai was not involved in either game. Obviously, the two centre-backs, Maya Yoshida and Takehiro Tomiyasu, picked themselves. And I guess the other major talking point from defence is the situation at left-back, Sam, where Yuto Nagatomo got the nod to start both games. But, I mean, you know, full-back is not generally a position that managers look to change throughout the course of the game. But in both of these qualifiers, Yuta Nakayama has come on just past the hour for Nagatomo. So is this, and it should it be, a gradual handing over of the torch? Should Nagatomo be phased out or, I mean, you know, not included completely from future squads, do you think? I mean, Nakayama obviously won the ball back and passed it to Mitoma for the winner against Oman. So whether Nagatomo would have been in that same position to make that same tackle and the same pass to Mitoma obviously is up for debate. But, Nakayama's had a huge impact on Japan winning that second game. And, I mean, there are definite calls for it. And, you don't have to look any further than the JTalk Patreon-only line group for people who are plumping for Nakayama to get the shirt. Which way do you size it up? Obviously, I've got a soft spot for Nagatomo, but I mean, if you're going to take a fullback off after 60 minutes, then it kind of defeats the purpose for me.
Yeah, that's the exact problem I have. If Moriarty doesn't believe that Nagatomo can make it through 90 minutes in these games, then you shouldn't be starting him, I don't think. You're wasting a substitution by just changing left-back when you could be, especially nil-nil in this sort of game against Oman, you need to go for more attacking options, because it's not like Nakayama is an express left-back that is going to be bombing up and down the wing. He's not adding anything to that. So, yeah, if Nagatomo is going to come off after 60 minutes each time, then, to be honest, I don't think he needs to start. I'm not against him being in the squad, because this squad, I think there's a transition going on. We're bringing in a lot of younger players, so you need players like Nagatomo and Yoshida in the squad. But, yeah, I think maybe it's time for him to move on. And because is he really going to be playing at the World Cup at 36? Is he a better player than Nakayama? I think they're kind of meeting in the middle at the moment. And whenever I consider two players to be pretty similar in quality, I think you've got to go with a younger player. So for me, although Nakayama, I don't think he's the greatest left back in the world. And I think that's another problem position for Japan. I think this is probably time that Nakayama takes over from Nagatomo. But keep Nagatomo in the squad, absolutely, because, yeah, on his day, he's still a decent left-back, and he's got all that experience that is going to be needed in the squad.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's a tough one for me, I say, as a Tokyo supporter. But, yeah, the time, the clock is definitely ticking for our Yuto, there's no question. And, with the Nakayama, obviously enhancing his chances there with the, playing his part in the winner against Oman. And then I guess for now, we would definitely hope that Wataru Endo and Ao Tanaka are established in midfield. And the only question is whether Hidemasa Morita is needed alongside those two, or whether Moriyasu can try and introduce another attacker, and he can trust that Tanaka can do, you know, half a defensive job alongside Endo, who is the main holder. We're gradually segueing on to Nick's question about the sort of Japan 11 we might like to see if Moriyasu keeps his job and or if he's ultimately moved on. But, do you feel there's a need for three proper centre mids in there? I mean, you could be it could be necessary against Saudi Arabia in the qualifier after China in the next international break. But otherwise, in this group anyway, there aren't really that many teams you would expect Japan to need power in midfield.
Yeah, I think there are certain occasions it'd be good to have those three central midfielders in there. But generally speaking, I don't think it's needed. Endo, I mean, he's the captain for a Bundesliga team. He's a very good holding midfielder, so I think he needs to be given a bit more trust in there. And Tanaka is a terrific box-to-box midfielder. He will run and do all the hard yards and around Endo, so I think those two can cope in midfield on their own, and it has that link, especially if Moriyasu is going to play Osako. As I mentioned before, you can bring Minamino into that number 10 position, or Kamada, or so many players that Japan have got, Kubo when he's back. You can bring someone into there and you have a bit more creativity, because, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, it's just that gap between midfield and striker, and it's just really not working. They need that link. So, yeah, I think just trust needs to be put in Endo, because he's a terrific player and I think a very good holding midfielder. So I think him and Tanaka, or if you want to go Endo and Morita, that's fine as well. But I think it really only needs the two players in there, especially against them, most teams that they'll come up against in qualifying.
All right. And then, at the sharp end of the pitch then, the same front three started both games, Ito, Osako and Minamino. I mean, Ito's obviously grabbed the headlines, and fair enough too. He's arrived in the right place at the right time to score two vitally important goals for his country. He has had his detractors in the past on this podcast especially, and whether this has gone some way towards convincing some of his detractors that he's not just a player that can run really fast in a straight line or not, I'm not sure. But, I mean, that second goal that that obviously should have been allowed against Vietnam was an indication of his, excellent abilities, that he's, not just a potential Olympic sprinter. But, I guess it's just a matter of working the balance and, working out how many, central midfielders you need and then working your squad around that, Sam. But, I mean, for the people who have had their doubts about Ito, I don't know, does two goals in consecutive qualifiers do enough to convince them that he might be the right man for the job on the right for Japan?
Like, I don't think it probably would. I think he played very well against Vietnam, and he showed a bit more of the quality that he has done in Belgium and he has done in the Europa League this year. Like, when he's on it, I mean, he can take on his player. He can be very good. He does have an end product. I mean, the two games against West Ham that Genk played earlier this season that I caught, I think he was absolutely terrific. He was their best player. So he has got that in him. And I think in a Moriyasu team, he has stood out just because he is a direct option. And he's not like they've had Minamino and Osaka who kind of converge in the middle. And he's the only one that will go in on goal. So that's where he's kind of, looked quite good. But in an ideal world, we'd have Mitoma and Furuhashi would be the direct options, and then there might not be the need for Ito there. So I think that, when we get on to Nick's question, I think Ito, although I quite like Ito and I'm not necessarily one of his detractors, I don't think he makes it in there because I don't think you need, as we saw in that second half where they played Furuhashi and Mitoma and Ito and Osaka were going along as well. They went from a stage where everyone in the first half was just stood still, and in the second half, everyone just went long, and you still got the massive gap. And it just really didn't work. And it was just like Moriyasu thought, I've got to bring these players on because that's really what I should be doing, but I don't really know how to use them. And it completely didn't work. And he just relied on a moment of magic from Mitoma to set up the goal, because Ito himself, he said afterwards, which was quite refreshing, that he didn't play very well. So, I don't think he'll have done his helped his detractors out or anything like that. But I'm happy for him that in that first game, he did play very well. And he did show that he can be a very good asset. And that sort of player, as an impact substitute, I think is ideal for Japan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. All right. So we obviously did get to see Kyogo Furuhashi come on actually at the same time as Nakayama, so just past the hour, and a sublime piece of skill to take a ball down, a high ball over the top, and shift it on to his preferred foot for a shooting attempt that was ultimately blocked, but then wiped away by one of those wretched delayed offside decisions. But there's no doubting of Furuhashi's quality. Obviously, we all know that. Anybody who listens to this podcast knows that we are big fans of Kyogo, who obviously was the top scorer in the J League when he left. And I'm not sure if he still is, Sam, but he probably still is the top scorer in the Scottish Premier League as well. So he's had an absolutely terrific season so far in two different countries. And what does Hajime Moriyasu need to see? And that's what we're coming on to. But ultimately, it's two vitally important wins for Japan. We've obviously had a bit of a sook about the way they came about, but at the end of the day, it's 6 points that they desperately needed. And as Sam mentioned earlier, Australia have drawn both of their games in this international break, and so they've slipped to third in the group, Australia, and as Sam said again, Japan now have qualification in their own hands with the four games to go in the group. There's obviously a myriad of questions, a myriad of problems that are still facing the Japan national team, who have scored only five goals in six qualifiers. That's a fewer than Oman and China, who are below them, much further below them in the group. But we'll look ahead ever so briefly before we properly address Nick's question. So, the next two fixtures are in January and very early February next year. Japan host China on the 27th of January, and then host Saudi Arabia on the 1st of February. So two huge qualifiers, no question, before the final two games are in March. Japan are away in Australia and then home to Vietnam in the final game. So I guess, well, we've spent the last 10 minutes or so, Sam, talking about the personnel available to Hajime Moriyasu and how they've performed over the course of these two games and whether we think they're options going forward. So off his own bat, Nick sent me a question on Wednesday afternoon that we very much appreciate. More meat on the bone for this episode, Nick. So, yeah, much appreciated. And he's wondering, after watching, watching is not the right word, after checking out some of Alan Gibson's tweets in the lead up to the Oman game, and, you know, Alan basically predicted Moriyasu's lineup spot on, even though that's not what he would have plumped for. Nick wants to know what are our preferred lineups if Moriyasu keeps his job and then if he is ultimately replaced, which a lot of people would still obviously be in favor of, wouldn't they, Sam? But it's hard to see after Japan have won three qualifiers on the spin. So Nick says for him, the big difference between the two setups, obviously Moriyasu in or Moriyasu out, would be Yuya Osako. Nick says, yeah, a lot of people are clamoring for Furuhashi, but with Moriyasu's defensive style, he doesn't think that Furuhashi as the main striker would work, and that a target man type seems necessary there. Maybe Ado or Naiwu, or even right out of left fielder Taichi Hara could get a look. So before we talk about Moriyasu out, if he does stay in the job, Sam, and we know his again, prejudice is too strong a word, but his preferences, that's a much better word. How do you think Moriyasu could or should or could set things up to get more out of the players that he clearly wants to put a lot of faith in?
Well, this is a really good question. It's a really difficult one, because I think if you put the Brazil 1970 squad playing the way that they played against Oman with a tactical setup, I don't think you'd get anything out of them either. But you've got a if you're going to play Osako, which is the way he wants to play, that sort of target man, I don't think there is necessarily a better option at playing that role than Osako. And you see how well he plays with Muto at Kobe. And I think his best attribute is to bring out the best in people around him. But for whatever reason, he hasn't got anyone around him at the moment for Japan, because they just leave a gap. So the biggest thing I would do with the system, so you're playing 4-3-3, which is the way that Kawasaki set up. It's that same way, but Kawasaki will get Hatate to be close to Damian or Wakizaka or someone like that. So I think you've got to bring in a Minamino or a Kamada or a Kubo into that midfield three and have them as the more advanced option. And then you've got to play an actual winger on the wing, because he wants to play wide wingers. So it seems obvious that you play Mitoma if you want your winger to hug the touchline. So I think that's what you do. You take out Morita. You'd play Minamino, for example, in that position. He'd get him close to Osako and work that way. And then when you go wide, you've got wingers in Ito and Mitoma, who are keen to go past their opponent, keen to make things and get the ball into the box and provide Osako with service. Because at the moment, I can see why everyone wants to get rid of him, because basically he doesn't do anything, because the ball never goes to him. Or if it does go to him, he's got no one to work with. So that's what he has to do. But is he going to do that with this preferred option of like three quite deep center midfielders? Because I agree with what Nick says, that in this system, Furuhashi is pointless, because the three in midfield, none of them look to go forward and look to play the early pass. Every time they were faced with anyone, they just went backwards. And they were never looking for runners. And occasionally, it was only really Ito making runs, but he was ignored every time. So yeah, you've got to get people around Osaka for it to work. I don't personally think that his system is going to work and is the right system with the manager. So I think it'd be really difficult to get it to work. But yeah, that's the only thing I could really say, just other than play better and play with a bit more intensity. But yeah, what about you? Do you see any hope for the Moriyasu system?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a couple of tweaks. Like, again, it would be a shame for me personally to see Nagatomo phased out. But yeah, I mean, give Nakayama a chance. I mean, it's again, that's not necessarily changing anything going forward, is it? But, you know, a little tweak here or there. I agree that, yeah, only two. You really only need two center mids. So, you know, if he could go to a diamond, again, he would need. He would need Kubo fit, but I'd like to see Kubo on the right, and again Ito as an impact sub I'd like to see Mitoma start on the left, but I mean, I just think it's wishful thinking. I think we should just segue on to the Moriyasu out part of this, because then we can properly play fantasy football, because we can construct a really mouth-watering looking attack, and that would put the fear of God into a number of international teams, not just the ones taking part in these Asian qualifiers. So, I mean, Nick says, again, this is, I'm presuming from his message, that this is Moriyasu out here, that his preferred style might just be a Manchester City style, let's just throw six attacking players out there. But as Nick says, that would need a massive change in philosophy at the JFA, and a new manager to come in and do something radical that we've never seen before in Japanese football. So that might be asking a little bit too much. I think we can probably say that Endo and Tanaka would keep their places under a new manager as things stand at the moment, Sam. So again, presuming that the keeper is up for debate, and the back four is some sort of version of what we've seen over the past couple of international breaks. So if you were tasked with setting up Japan, a Japan attack to do damage in Qatar next year, again hoping that Japan make it, what would your dream lineup be?
Well, I'd start with the template of what's been the best team in Japan. It's Kawasaki. We'll play like that. That's the way I'd go. And Endo and Tanaka work perfectly in that midfield. I think on the right, they have Ienaga, that player that kind of cuts in a little bit. I think Doan would be perfect for that on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. I'd bring him in. I'd play Kubo as the extra midfielder, the one that gets in behind the striker. And yeah, just, I mean, obviously, everyone knows what Kubo's about, and terrific player. Obviously, Mitoma has to play left wing, because he changed the game inside 30 seconds when he came on against Oman. He did the same at the Olympics against Mexico. Why it has to be when everything's all gone and it looks horrible that is the only time that Moriyasu will go to him, I don't know. But yeah, he has to play every game for me. And then Furuhashi is definitely the best striker. He's in such good form. And then you've got those players around him. Kubo and Doan can play the balls through to him, like work with his runs. Mitoma can be an outlet on the left-hand side. I just think that's got a bit, that would, for me, is the ideal like front six for Japan. It's still got the solidity of Endo and Tanaka, but it's got really good expressive players going forward. And with the amount of players that Japan have in attack, there are so many options that you could bring off the bench as well. I mean, Daisen Maeda has not had a look in this, but he could be a wonderful option off the bench, as could Ito, as could Ueda, or any number of players. So, yeah, that's the way I would go. Have you got any alternatives to that?
Yeah, I mean, apologies, and it's it doesn't look great after these two games, but yeah, my Liverpool bias is showing. I would put Minamino behind Furuhashi and play Kubo on the right. But apart from, I mean, yeah, you could knock me off that very easily. I mean, he's not playing for Liverpool, so you could see that it's difficult for him to just walk into a Japan national team, even though he's obviously got the reputation. He wasn't match sharp, and I mean, you know, got the assist in the first game, but the system's not set up to get the best out of him. I appreciate that, but if he was fit and firing and at his best, I would think that he would do a great job for Japan behind Furuhashi. But yeah, again, I wouldn't live and die on that hill. But yeah, for my dream team, yes, I'd have Kubo on the right and Taki in the middle and Mitoma on the left with Furuhashi banging them in up front for whoever the new manager might be. But I guess, Sam, as this group progresses, and by hook or by crook, these results have turned for Hajime Moriyasu, it's just difficult to see when the time might be right for the JFA to actually act, because surely he can't actually take them to Qatar, can he? I mean, I guess he can get them there, and then does he realize that it's not working, and that he he should stand down and somebody else should take them on ahead of the World Cup. But then again, I mean, he's a proud man and he's won, you know, 3 J1 titles with Hiroshima, and he you know, he's tasked with a job to get Japan to the World Cup, so he's going to want to manage them there. I mean, it's a really difficult situation, isn't it? And especially if things go for Japan in the next 2 qualifiers. I mean, you know, Australia could drop more points for all we know, and Japan might be very, very close to automatically qualifying before they even have to travel to Australia in March. So, you know, all this wishful thinking. I mean, if he ekes out a couple more results in January/February, it might almost be impossible for them to replace him.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing last night, I think Dan Olowitz tweeted that there was a Moriyasu out was trending on Twitter last night. So there is some discontent still there. And
a groundswell.
Yeah, so maybe that could force him out. But I agree, if Moriyasu gets them there, there's no way, if I was Moriyasu, I'd resign. If I've taken my country to a World Cup, I'd want to manage there, and you never know what might happen. But I'd still get rid of him today. I was still woke up this morning and just fingers crossed that maybe they'd made a decision. But again, wishful thinking. And yeah, if they're not done it this week, then it's going to continue into January, and they'll probably eke out a 1-0 against China at home, and then there's Saudi Arabia next. They might get a draw and just about survive there and still be second, and then we go on and go on, and he just kind of falls his way into managing at the World Cup, which maybe at that point, and it looks horrendous when they're drawn against actual quality teams and just get blown away, and then they might look for a change. But yeah, it's kind of like kind of depressing, really, just that this is going to go on for a while and we're probably just stuck in it for another year.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, yeah, they're still alive and kicking, and it's thanks to Ito Ham. So well done, Junior, on your 2 goals. And yeah, obviously, as an Australian, it was a bittersweet international break, because it's now out of Australia's hands. And yes, it looks almost certain that, yes, my dream of Japan and Australia both going through automatically is looking very, very unlikely at this stage with the 4 qualifiers left. But we will wait and see. And obviously, yes, we'll be all over the next international break at the end of January. As by that time, Sam, we'll be up and running in J1 again, won't we, just about. So, yes, we'll be back, obviously, to talk about those qualifiers when they come around. And, okay, well, yeah, they said we couldn't do it, but there you go, Sam. Almost 40 minutes on 2 1-0 wins for Japan. We will pause for a quick hit of music, and we'll be back to ever so briefly preview this coming Saturday's J1 Match Day 36. J1 resumes this Saturday with Match Day 36. And after all these international breaks, the final 3 rounds of the top flight season will be played on consecutive Saturdays. There are slightly staggered kickoff times this week, but then the following 2 Saturdays, all games will kick off at 2 p.m. Obviously, a lot of our focus in recent weeks has been on the relegation dogfight, where with the 3 games remaining, 6 points separates the bottom 6 from Shonan in 15th. They are goal difference ahead of Shimizu, down to bottom club Yokohama FC, who are goal difference behind Sendai. And Sam, 2 of those clubs meet in one of the 6 games at 2 p.m. on Saturday, and without question, the biggest game of the match day, when Shonan travel up to Sendai, for whom it's last chance saloon time. If they lose and Shimizu take anything from their home clash with Hiroshima kicking off at 3 p.m., then Vegalta will be confirmed relegated with the 2 games to play, and their 12-year run in the top flight will come to an end at the end of the season. So it's the ultimate backs to the wall game for the hosts. Can they hang on for another week, do you think?
Yeah, they can. I think the J League never usually lets things peter out to nothing, so I'm sure we'll get a few twists and turns. And I think the last two games before the international break. They performed quite well against Nagoya and Kobe. They only got the 1 point out of it, but there was definite fight there. So they'll still believe that they can beat Shonan, get themselves to within 3 points of safety with two games to go and give themselves a real chance. So, yeah, all to play for. It's the ideal game, I think, for Sendai. It's the one they'd want to try and drag one of Shonan or Shimizu in with them. So, and this is, yeah, it's rare that you'd say Sendai and Shonan is the best game of the weekend, but it's the one I'm most looking forward to. And I think definitely Sendai have a chance, but yeah, Shonan will look at it the other way and think we can get ourselves pretty much safe with a win here. So, yeah, all to play for both sides, and I'm hoping for a really exciting match.
Yes, that's not usually the case, as you say, when both of these teams are involved. But yes, we can hope, and I'm sure there'll be no shortage of drama. Obviously, Belmare blew a huge chance to put further breathing room between themselves and the drop zone in the final match day before the international break, when they were held at 0-0 at home by a 10-man. Sanfrecce Hiroshima, who played it was the last 70 minutes or so, wasn't it, with 10 men. Yes, Belmare will hope that those 2 points that they failed to earn will not come back to bite them at the end of the season. But Sendai have struggled pretty much for the entire campaign, and Belmare will go up there with the hopes of basically sealing their survival. They have such a huge goal difference advantage over the rest of the bottom six that, a Belmare win would all but mathematically seal their top flight status if, Tokushima lose. Tokushima in 17th, of course, and Oita in 18th fail to win away from home. So at 2 p.m., Vortis travel to FC Tokyo, who will have an under new management sign hanging outside Ajinomoto Stadium. And at 3, Trinita head up to Kashima to face an Antlers side, who are now the closest challengers to Kobe in the battle for third spot and automatic ACL qualification. But Sam, I'd argue that they're unlikely to make up too much ground this week, Antlers. On Kobe, that is, as Vissel are away at the Cellar Dwellers Yokohama FC, for whom it's also last chance saloon time in another one of the 3 p.m. kickoffs.
Yeah, you would expect Kobe to kind of ease their way through that game, but Yokohama FC have put up good performances against Yokohama F. Marinos and against Kashima. They're fighting for their lives, so you never know. But yeah, Kobe, you would expect, they've been quite professional at the end of this season, which is rare from a Kobe side to be doing that. But they look like they're on their way to, yeah, pretty comfortably so wrapping up third place. So I would be surprised if they didn't beat Yokohama here and keep at least that 5 point gap going into the final two games.
Yeah, fair enough. Then, so it might be on to Salo Mineiro and Yusuke Matsuo to turn it on for the Mitsuzawa faithful. But it might be too little, too late. Whatever happens there on Saturday afternoon, and Kobe could actually, they could lock up a third spot, couldn't they? If Antlers somehow fall to Oita, and also Nagoya Grampus failed to win away at Gamba Osaka in one of the other 2 p.m. kickoffs, then it could be all locked up for Vissel with the two games to go. We shall see. Anything else on the Match Day 36 fixture list that grabs your fancy, Sam, before we wrap things up?
Oh, well, yes, interesting. There's not necessarily a standout game besides that, obviously. Reds versus F. Marinos, just as a fixture, should be really exciting. I mean, two very attacking teams generally, so there could be a terrific game there. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, that most games are wrapped up in this relegation dogfight, and then you've got a few mid-table, who knows, games. So I don't know about Tosu versus Sapporo, for example, but yeah, I think the standout, besides the games that matter, is Reds versus F. Marinos. But all my focus, I think, is going to be on the relegation battles, and especially the Yokohama, the Sendai, and the Oita games. I think, you get enough drama in there for a weekend.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. All right, so, 10 games to come on Saturday. And, we'll obviously be back to wrap them up. And as this podcast is heading out to you listeners on Thursday, we'll be back with you again fairly sharpish for our next episode. In the coming days, we'll also have some new player of the season polls posted on Patreon for our patrons to vote on. Basically, as you might remember, we began our series of a player of the season awards with the five teams in mid-table who are basically playing out the string. Well, the next four teams are two from above that group and two from below them. Reds and Tosu are now almost certainly out of the race for third. In fact, Tosu mathematically are, and Reds almost certainly will be after this weekend. While below Sapporo, Gumba and Kashua Reysol have obviously both sealed their top flight status in match day 35. So, yes, we can put some names forward for our patrons to vote on for a player of the season for those four teams. And so patrons, keep your eyes peeled for those polls in the coming days, definitely before our next episode early next week. All right, Sam. So, probably a longer chat than we both expected about the national team, but it's plenty to chew on despite the lack of goals. We do fear still for Japan under Hajime Moriyasu, don't we? But two vitally important wins that, as we've said numerous times, puts their fate back into their own hands. So we can be thankful for that at least. And let's get rolling again. We've got three match days to go in J1. Hopefully they will be packed full of drama, and we'll have some interest to run right through until the final day. So we're looking forward to catching up with you again next week.
Yeah, always good to catch up with you. It's been great to get back to the J-League, I think. I've had enough of Japan for 1 year. We'll deal with them again in January. And I, as a neutral, I just hope, I'm sorry to Kobe and Kashima and Shonan supporters, but I'm hoping for three victories for Oita, Sendai and Yokohama to get this really close as we end the season. I really want a terrific relegation dogfight.
Yes, it has been fascinating so far. Let's hope it goes right down to the wire. All right, so that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Nick Walker very much for his question on the Japan national team for us to ponder on this week's episode. Nick is a patron of the J-Talk podcast. If you'd like to be like Nick, one of the cool kids, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And, we'd obviously like to thank you, listeners, for listening wherever you are, especially those of you who might have tuned in for the first time on the back of Paul Williams's article on Optus Sport that I obviously tongue-in-cheek described as a hatchet job right back at the start of the episode. I very much appreciated Paul taking the time to do that. And, turned out really well, I think. So thanks again to Paul and everyone at Optus Sport for agreeing that was a good idea in the first place. All right, so we will leave it there, and we'll be back next week to chat about all of the games from J1 Match Day 36. Speak to you next week. Bye for now. This is how you got to get through 9 years, mate. You've just got to keep yourself amused.
The J-Talk Podcast.
Your ham is oishi.
Yosh, 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 yosh.